Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Americans wonder about the potential role of radical Islam in a free Egypt, writer and activist Reza Aslan has some provocative thoughts. In a Newsweek Washington Post piece, he says when it comes to the role of religion in politics, Americans and Egyptians are pretty well in agreement. Mike Huckabee, are you listening? Reza Aslan joins me now. He is a Daily Beast contributor and creative writing professor at the University of California in Riverside, probably best known as the author of the best-selling book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, which was also named one of the 100 most important books of the last decade. He has also written How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of War, the War on Terror, and his most recent, Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East. I'm glad to say he's been on the show for each of those three book releases. And we welcome him back to talk about current conditions. Reza, welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be back.
And let's start with that notion of Americans and Egyptians largely agreeing about the role of religion in politics and democracy. What do you base that on?
Well, I was referencing a 2010 Pew Research poll that showed attitudes about the role of religion in politics in a number of countries. Specifically, they asked Egyptians whether they would want religion to play a role in their government. Some 95% of Egyptians, which means both Muslims and Christians, said they would want religion to play a role. The numbers in the U.S. were smaller, but still quite significant. About 60% of Americans said that they want their political leaders to have a religious faith, and for that religious faith to have an influence in their political decisions.
Where does Mike Huckabee come in?
Well, of course, Mike Huckabee, who has been sounding the alarm bells about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt's uprising and what that could mean for Israel, what it could mean for the United States, etc., is probably from the most famous of the Christian nationalists in the United States. Of course, this is a man who has repeatedly exhorted Americans to, quote, take the nation back for Christ. If you remember, near the end of his run for the Republican nomination for president a couple of years ago, he quite famously said in a speech that he would like to change the Constitution so that it is in alignment with what he referred to as God's values. And the point that I was making was that the fact is that Mike Huckabee and indeed many of the Christian conservatives in the United States have far more in common with the Muslim Brotherhood than they would like to admit, in that all of them very much want to see a role for religion in society. They want to see society founded upon a very specific moral framework, in the case of the Christian right, obviously Christianity, and with the Muslim Brotherhood, Islam.
But that's where the conversation starts, not where it ends, right? I mean, you're an immigrant from Iran. Mike Huckabee probably doesn't want the same role for religion in America as the Ayatollah Khomeini wanted for Iran. He probably doesn't want the same role for Christianity in America as the Taliban imposed with their version of Islam for Afghanistan, or the Saudi government imposes, et cetera, et cetera. So how far do those similar polls about wanting a role for religion get us?
Well, that's a very good point. But of course, neither does the Brotherhood want either a Taliban-style government or an Iranian theocracy. Quite the contrary. The Brotherhood is quite a moderate organization. They've undergone a massive evolution. They've given up the violence since the 1960s. They've already taken part in the democratic process. They've proven themselves to be capable of responsible governance. They've worked across the aisle with other opposition figures to work towards greater freedoms of speech, greater freedoms of religion. As I say, they've completely renounced violence, which is why groups like Al-Qaeda see the Muslim Brotherhood as their greatest enemy. Indeed, Ayman Zawahiri, bin Laden's right-hand man, has written a 700-page tome condemning the Muslim Brotherhood. At the same time, though, it is important to understand that simply because they represent Islam, that is enough for a lot of Americans, including Mike Huckabee, to immediately tag them with the label of Taliban or the Iranian theocracy. The point that I'm making is that many of these Christian nationalists in the United States, including Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, are incapable of thinking that Islam could play the same role in a Muslim-majority state like Egypt that Christianity should play in their desire in a Christian-majority state like the United States. And insofar as, you know, where those values are, I mean, yes, certainly. I mean, no one is saying that Mike Huckabee, wants to or is not a pluralist and wants to deny rights to people of other religions. But let's make it very clear. What he wants to do is dictate the rights and freedoms of Americans insofar as those rights are alignment with his view of Christian values and morals.
So where do you come down if you're going to apply a value judgment as a consistent standard? In other words, most of our listeners, we're in New York, you know, most of our listeners would reject Mike Huckabee and say it's dangerous to freedom to see politics as taking America back for Christ, and would also be dangerous to approach Egypt as taking it back for Muhammad. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. Anytime you bring religion into the fold, and particularly when you break down the wall between the public and the private realms, which is really what you're talking about, you say religion should play a role in defining the morality of a state, then you're opening up a can of worms. I mean, you're getting into a situation in which you could conceivably deny rights and freedoms to religious minorities, or you could deny rights and freedoms to people who you believe do not deserve the same rights as people of the majority religion. That said, there's really nothing to be done about this, Brian. I mean, the truth is that if society is to be centered upon the values and mores and traditions of the majority, as long as the minority is protected, that's kind of what we get when we have a democracy. See, in the United States, we may not want Christian nationalists to have a role in our politics, making decisions for us. But we're a democracy, and that's not how it works. In a democracy, everyone gets a chance to present their ideas to the populace, and the populace decides whether they agree with those ideas or not. Well, that's what we're hoping is going to happen in these Muslim-majority states. And so we can't start a democratic process in a place like Egypt by simply cutting out a group that represents some 20 to 25% of the Egyptian populace. They need to have a voice, some role in government, and we need to allow Egyptians to decide for themselves whether that position, that ideology is good for Egypt or bad for Egypt. If they think it's good for Egypt, they'll vote for it. If it turns out to be bad for Egypt in a democratic process, they get to vote these bums out, as we say.
Listeners, any phone calls for Reza Aslan? Best known for his book, No God But God, also Tablet and Pen, and How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror, 212-433-WNYC. Muslims, Christians, Huckabee supporters, anybody, 212-433-9692. What do you think is going to happen in Egypt? When they get to writing a post-Mubarak Egyptian constitution, assuming that will happen, do you think a struggle will develop between more radical religionists and those who would want more of a secular democracy with some influence of religion?
I think what we have discovered in places like Turkey, like Indonesia, like Malaysia, and even in places like Jordan, is that when you give legitimate religious opposition groups, groups that are willing to put down their guns and pick up a ballot and take part in the political process, it sort of moderates their radical tendencies. It takes the wind out of the more radical groups, because if the aspirations of those who are religiously inclined have an opportunity to be met in some way in the political process, then the argument for those who present a more radical agenda, groups like Al-Qaeda, that the entire system needs to be scrapped and started all over again, that what we need is a revolution, etc., really goes away. And so I think providing a role for a group like the Muslim Brotherhood in the political process in Egypt is the ideal way to take away the sort of strength of radicalism. And look at Turkey. You know, Turkey, thanks to the success of the Justice and Development Party, a mildly Islamist political party that has brought that country closer to a true democracy than it has ever been, there is simply no room in Turkey anymore for any kind of Islamic radicalism.
What about Iran as a lesson of any kind, cautionary tale, or whatever, your country of origin? You know, on Friday in our theater, The Green Space, here at WNYC, we're doing a special edition of this program called What Happens After a Revolution. And we're gathering up people who've lived through revolutions in lots of countries, because so many people come to New York. Eventually, we can do that here. And we're asking them about the lessons, good or bad, for Egypt and other countries overthrowing their dictators today. If you're in New York, we'd love to have you. But what would you say about your country of origin, Iran? There was hope for a democratic Iran when the Shah was overthrown in 1979, but the Ayatollah Khomeini's faction won the day and established their theocracy. Could it have turned out differently?
It most certainly could have turned out differently for, you know, a whole host of reasons, not least because if the United States and the Western world had sort of read the tea leaves a little bit earlier and realized that there was no more use in continuing to support the American-backed dictator, the Shah of Iran, then I think we would have had a different relationship with post-revolutionary Iran. People are constantly making the comparison between what's happening right now in Egypt to what happened in Iran in 1979 and referencing Carter when talking about Obama. Well, if there is a comparison to be made, it's that. It's that we have to make sure that we know that the game is over for Mubarak, and that, like it or not, the days of the American-backed dictator in Egypt are over. So we need to recognize that the sooner that we land on the side of people, the sooner we can develop a more positive, more constructive relationship with post-revolutionary Egypt. That's the lesson that we need to learn from our mistake with regard to Iran.
Are you saying that Iran largely turned to the Ayatollah in 1979 because of actions by the West, especially the United States, while the Shah was still in power, rather than some internal dynamics after the Shah?
No, the internal dynamics had a lot to do with the role of the foreign powers in that revolution. There's no question about it. When you had secularists like Bazargan and you know, the provisional government that was very much open to relations with the West and trying desperately before the Shah left to open a line of communication with the White House, but being repeatedly rebuffed by people like, for instance, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who really to the end continued to push the Carter administration to stay steadfast on the side of the Shah. The same is true of Senator Rockefeller. The same is true of Henry Kissinger. I think we would have had a different relationship had we understood very early on that the Shah was done and that we needed to put our strengths and our moral support towards the revolutionaries in hope of having some influence in what happened after the Shah left.
Do you think that the U.S. is risking a more radical post-Mubarak Egypt by taking the tack that it's taking right now, which is embracing a gradual transition led by Vice President Suleiman? Secretary Clinton would say this is in order to help make sure that it isn't a chaotic power struggle, but an actual transition to real democracy.
I think Barack Obama is a student of history. I think he knows exactly what happened in 1979. And while he has been quite cautious, it's not because of Mubarak. It's because of our allies in the region, particularly the Saudis and the Israelis, neither of whom want to see Mubarak go by any stretch of the imagination. Nevertheless,
but that's a done deal, isn't it? I mean, that's a fait accompli. It's just a question of how at this point.
That's right. And if you talk to the Egyptians on the street, and I have had a chance to do so, they will tell you that they're, for the most part, they're fairly happy with Obama's approach. He hasn't been too hands-on. He hasn't given the Mubarak regime an opportunity to pretend this is all some kind of Western-backed conspiracy, even though they've tried. At the same time, he's made it very clear that his support for Mubarak it has limits, and that indeed those limits have been reached. So I think for the most part, the Obama administration is playing this fairly well. But at a certain point, it's going to have to come out and very strongly state that it is behind the Egyptian people. First, however, it wants to make sure that what comes after is something that it can live with. And that's, I think, what you're seeing behind the scenes right now, particularly in its discussions with the Egyptian military. Remember, Brian, we have very, very close relationship with the Egyptian military. We give them almost $2 billion a year. That we train their generals here in the United States. It's not just a professional relationship by all accounts. It's quite a close friendship. So make no mistake, right now, we are in negotiations with the Egyptian military to figure out how to make a peaceful transition to a more democratic Egypt.
Reza Aslan, author of books including No God But God, How to Win a Cosmic War, and Tablet and Pen. And to our busy phones, Bernard in Greenwich Village. You're on WNYC. Hello, Bernard.
Hi. I think your guest misrepresents the Muslim Brotherhood in a way so as to revive the old convergence theory of international politics. Huckabee does not represent the U.S. and would not end up, for example, killing Muslims. And yet, you cannot look at the history of Egypt over the last 30 years, which is a kind of perfect time space, without seeing that the Muslim culture in Egypt kills Christians all the time. They are regular victims of the very people who your guest would compare with Huckabee. I'm not supporting Huckabee, but I am deeply opposed to the revival of the
Muslim Brother
theory.
All right. Convergence theory,
well,
Reza.
Look, what your caller is doing is making the same mistake that Huckabee is making, which is to compare the Muslim Brotherhood with obvious, yes, there are obvious groups in Egypt, individuals in Egypt, who have no tolerance for other religions and who have acted out in extreme violence against the Coptic minority. It's just they're not in the Muslim Brotherhood. And so that's the problem, is that by definition, because the Muslim Brotherhood has the word Muslim in its name, it is being tagged as Al-Qaeda, as Hamas, as Taliban. There has to be some kind of sophistication, I hope, in the American public to be able to differentiate between, you know, radical individuals who, as your caller said, quite rightly have no tolerance for people of other religions, and any group that just happens to be Muslim. And that's the problem. That's what's not happening. So, yes, you're right. Mike Huckabee isn't calling for the death of, say, you know, abortion doctors, but other Christians in the United States are. So, therefore, Mike Huckabee is. I mean, that's a false analogy, obviously.
And you're saying the same thing applies to the Muslim Brotherhood as opposed to more radical Muslim groups or Muslim individuals. You know, I'm going to interview for later in the week Lawrence Wright, who wrote The Looming Tower. And so I've been revisiting some of that material. And he says that Al-Qaeda's bloodthirsty nature was born from the brutality of Egyptian prisons. And it was the brutal treatment of Zawahiri when he was in prison in Egypt before he went on to become Al-Qaeda's number two, that helped form him and helped create the state of rage that we're probably seeing expressed on the streets of Egypt again today. What would you say? What's your understanding of the brutality of the Egyptian prisons? How it might contribute to whatever the Muslim Brotherhood sees itself as today, and the whatever radicalism might come from that.
That's right. I mean, this is a despicable, repressive, brutal regime that happens to, by the way, be a secular regime. And so because they have outlawed any kind of true liberal, secular, democratic opposition, the only thing that they can't control, really, is the mosques, which is perfectly normal that the primary opposition in Egypt to Mubarak's regime happens to be religious opposition, because it's the religious groups that are the only groups that have even a modicum of freedom to actually assemble and make themselves heard. Now, the one thing that's important, again, going back to Zawahiri and what Lawrence is saying, and he's absolutely right. I mean, that's also where Sayyid Qutb, the sort of the founder of Islamic radicalism, was radicalized in the dank, sadistic, torturous prisons of Egypt. What's really important to understand about those groups is that they see the Muslim Brotherhood as their enemy, because they see the Muslim Brotherhood as having betrayed the principles of Islam by denouncing violence, by working towards a pluralistic society, by wanting to take part in the government and to change it from the inside. That, to me, is the best way to fight against the kind of radicalism that has been such a scourge in the world. I mean, the best way to defeat al-Qaeda is to support the alternative to al-Qaeda, which is, in this case, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yusuf in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Yusuf.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I like to take exception to this qualification of the Muslim Brotherhood as such a benign organization, because it is the organization from under the umbrella of the Muslim Brotherhood. From that umbrella came out all the other organizations, Muslim Jihad, Hamas, Jamaa Islamiyah, the guys who killed Anwar Sadat. Essentially, the Muslim Brotherhood has politicized Islam, which is really the main difference between what he is talking about and the reality on the ground. The Muslim Brotherhood believes Islam is not a religion, but it is a political system. Under the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, a Christian cannot be president of Egypt. A woman cannot be a president of Egypt. Women have to be second-class citizens. So do Christians. The Muslim Brotherhood believes in no peace with Israel, no matter what we are hearing, the propaganda now. Their policy is no peace with Israel. So how can we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood as a benign organization? I hate the Mubarak regime, but my God, it would be a nightmare to live under a Muslim Brotherhood.
Yusuf, did you tell my screener you were a New York Times correspondent in Iran?
I was a New York Times correspondent in Iran, in fact, during the revolution. He's talking about us, the bureau chief of the New York Times.
Reza?
Well, yes, it's absolutely true that the Muslim Brotherhood invented what we now call Islamism, which is sort of, as the caller said, the idea of Islam as a political ideology, or what is often referred to as religious nationalism, Islamic religious nationalism. But I think it's sort of disingenuous to say that because groups have spun out of the Muslim Brotherhood, precisely because the Muslim Brotherhood rejected violence. So, for instance, it wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood that killed Sadat. It was the Islamic Jihad that killed Sadat. It wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood that founded Hamas. Hamas broke away from the Muslim Brotherhood and started a completely different ideology precisely because they rejected the Muslim Brotherhood's more accommodating stance. So you can't really blame the Muslim Brotherhood that people have broken away from it and radicalized in opposition to the Brotherhood ideals. At the same time, however, we have to recognize that this is a very religiously conservative organization, absolutely. Yes, they would not want anyone from the Christian minority, which makes up about 10% of Egypt, to run for president. I would say that Mike Huckabee wouldn't want anyone but a Christian to run for president in the United States. At the same time, they only represent about 20 to 25% of the Egyptian public. They're going to have a 20 to 25% role in the government, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. So the point of it that I'm trying to make is that working with the Brotherhood to make sure that, the rhetoric that they give about democracy and pluralism and how they want an Egypt for Egyptians, etc., is actually fulfilled. The worst thing that we could do is deny those aspirations, to repress them, to push them back.
We're going to run out of time in just a minute. Yusuf, do you agree with that last statement, that basically if we're for democracy in Egypt now and they do represent 25% of the population, they've got to have a 25% seat at the table, more or less?
Yes, the problem with the Muslim Brotherhood is their belief in democracy is basically one election, one time. And we have seen this over and over again in every Islamic regime.
No, actually, we have never seen it. There has never, this lie is getting outraged.
I think Iran is a very good example.
There has never been a time.
And Yusuf, hang on for just a second. My producer wants to ask you a question.
There has never been a time in which this idea of one election, one time has ever, ever proven true. And yet people keep saying it. People keep saying what the Muslim Brotherhood want is once they get 20% of power, then they'll scrap the Constitution and they'll never have elections again. Not only is that ridiculous because it's impossible, but it's never happened. There has never been a time in which a religious, Islamist organization was given the opportunity to take part in the political process and, once achieving some measure of power, put an end to elections altogether.
Never happened. Didn't it happen in Algeria in the 90s?
No, on the contrary. In Algeria, the Islamists won and the military threw them out of power and started a 10-year civil war that resulted in the deaths of 200,000 Algerians.
The military, horrible coup and horrible regime. But didn't the military stage that coup after an election in which an Islamist party won on the platform of one election, one time? And then they were going to impose Sharia law?
No, not at all. That's what the military said. They won the election, and immediately the military, without giving them an opportunity to even govern, immediately the military staged a coup. That's what led to the Algerian Civil War. So, again,
it was the
fear that they would do that resulted in the military coup.
All right. I guess we have to conclude that we're going to see what happens in Egypt. And I don't know, maybe do we conclude that we just don't know yet what the Muslim Brotherhood will be in a free Egypt as opposed to in an Egypt where they were really under Mubarak's thumb and allowed to exist at all, sort of at Mubarak's indirect pleasure?
That's right. We don't know, but what we do know is that they will have a role whether we like it or not, and the best thing that we can do is work with them, encourage them, allow them to transform into a democratic society. If we try to repress them, we'll radicalize them.
Reza Aslan, author of books including No God But God, How to Win a Cosmic War, and Tablet and Pen, contributor to The Daily Beast. His article that started all of this conversation was on the Washington Post and Newsweek website. Thank you so much, Reza.
Thanks, Brian. Anytime.
And again, listeners, we have about 25 tickets left for our live Brian Lehrer show Friday morning in the Green Space on this and related topics. We're framing it as What Happens After a Revolution, and we're gathering guests from literally all over the world whose countries have been through the overthrow of a dictator. Some revolutions end well, others end not so well. We'll hear their stories of change from Iran to South Africa and beyond, to look for lessons for Egypt and other countries today as they cast off their dictators and transition, hopefully, to democracy. It should be fascinating. With guests originally from the world over, it's at our regular live show time, 10 a.m., and if you want to come, you can buy tickets now for $10 at thegreenspace.org. Hope to see you Friday morning. Again, $10 tickets at thegreenspace.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. Britain on the verge of a double-dip recession. Is it despite the government's austerity measures or because of them?